Okay, welcome everyone around the world for the final session of the 2016 Football Scholars Forum as we enter the kind of mid-season break in the freezing cold up here in the north and in the beautiful sunshine and warmth of the south of this planet of ours. We have with us today J.R. Bierstecker, who's the filmmaker behind, mastermind behind the Men in the Arena film that we all watched, and just want to thank JR for joining us from Washington, D.C., where he's about to do an excellent presentation on this film at the Library of Congress. Very exciting. Congratulations on the impressive film, which took many years of work. I saw that you had a Kickstarter campaign to fund, I think it was the post-production. Really, an inspiring film. And we usually start with the author or filmmaker saying a few things, and maybe I can just lay the groundwork for your preliminary comments by saying that I noticed that you were inspired by a book by a Canadian journalist, or at least a journalist who works for the Toronto newspaper, Michelle Shepard, who wrote a book a few years ago entitled Decade of Fear, Reporting from Terrorism's Gray Zone. And she was talking about Somalia and also, I think, Yemen, if I remember correctly. And my question to you was, how does a white guy from the United States with a background in broadcast journalism, I think a BA degree in international business, get so interested in soccer's place in the lives of young Somali men?
Have you ever been on Wikipedia, like you heard a song on the radio and then you jump on Wikipedia and then 3 hours later, you're mired in the weeds of some other channel that you didn't expect to be in. that's kind of what happened here. You guys can hear me okay, correct?
Perfect.
Yes. Okay, good. My screen went away. So, one, thank you all for taking the time to watch the film and join the call. It's, after doing a journey like this for a really long time, to have people that are like willing to take the time and actually, you know, engage in the discussion, it's obviously really fun for me. To answer your question, it was Michelle Shepard who was on NPR's Fresh Air, and I was in the process of moving from New York to LA, and I needed a car. So I stopped back home in St. Louis and grabbed my sister's old Saturn, and I was going to take that with me out to LA. And I heard Michelle on the telling Terry Gross from NPR's Fresh Air about this young man in Mogadishu who had been publicly amputated by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu, because they had been in control of Mogadishu in 2010. And Michelle wrote the story, and the Canadian diaspora, the Somalis, really responded to her story. I think they were really moved by this young man's courage, who was 16 at the time, and two of his friends, and they didn't want to be boy soldiers. They wanted to get an education, and they paid a price for it. And because of her story, the diaspora did respond, and this young man, she went back along with some other people back in Mogadishu that really did some behind the scenes work, and they were able to get him on safe soil. And this young man, she wrote a follow-up piece, and he ended up in the Arctic Circle. And when I heard that story, I realized that I hadn't really thought about Somalia in a long time, and I hadn't thought about it except through a single story prism, which is terrorism, famine, piracy, the same thing that we always hear. And I think that that kid was living proof. Just when you see an image like the young man in Aleppo, or I think about, and from a visual sense, I think about Spielberg's Schindler's List and the young girl in the red dress walking through the city when everything else is just kind of mired in this what's about to be chaos. And I think as I dug deeper into 6 months of research after hearing that story, trying to understand more about Somalia and what was happening there, how a young person survives there, soccer seemed to be the one kind of thread of, wait, this feels like the hope story. And this feels like maybe there's something that's cohesive here. And when I learned more about the national team and FIFA coming in and laying some turf inside the national stadium, all of it was kind of coalescing around, like, maybe there's something here. Maybe this is the one place where we could try to have a through point to try to tell a story. And just to skip forward a little bit, I spent about 3 months trying to get a hold of the Somali Football Federation, which is no easy thing to do. And he called me, with the head of the Federation called me one day from Djibouti with a, you know, a terrible connection. And I basically said, hey, I'm in America and I want to tell a story about your team. And he's like, okay, great, come. And that didn't sound very safe. So I sent him kind of some information about what I wanted to do. And in the process, he was invited by FIFA to the Beach Soccer World Cup in Tahiti. And I got an email on a Sunday afternoon saying he was going to be there. And I knew that that was my shot. So 3 days later, I flew to French Polynesia on my own. Of course, I'm not independently wealthy, but cashed in some miles. And I spent 6 days trying to convince him that I wanted access to the team. And I guess about a month later, I found out that the team was competing in an annual tournament called CECAFA. And that's where the film opens up, is at CECAFA, at this tournament. And that's where we meet Saad and Sadiq. And that's where the journey really began. And what I didn't know, and just to kind of conclude, you know, this opening remarks, is what I never, I guess I could have expected it from my research and what I had learned. But kind of a little bit like Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down, he opens up the audio portion of the book saying that he wasn't a foreign war correspondent. So for him to go to Mogadishu in 1996, 3 years after Black Hawk Down, he had this sense of, I'm about to go do something that I haven't done before. I'm really in uncharted waters. But as a storyteller, he felt like that also allowed him to have a new perspective and a new light with which able to kind of tell that story. And that kind of emboldened me a little bit. I felt like when we got to Nairobi, Kenya, for this annual soccer tournament, that we had a chance to really think about how this soccer team could help us try to understand Somalia. And it was that first night that we handed out a questionnaire in Somali and in English to all the kids on the team, because we couldn't find any information on them online. And that's where we met Saad Sadiq. And that was the first time where I realized, oh, there's something special about these two. Not only their relationship, but as the days would unfold, we learned about just kind of how great their skill was on the field. So that kind of began what we thought would be a one-year journey that turned into three, because I never imagined that they're talking about Al-Shabaab would have such consequences. I didn't quite realize the depths of which I would have to go to make sure that their safety was ensured. So I hope that was somewhat informative. And you said make an intro that was 5 minutes, so hopefully that did it.
Perfect. Thank you. So we can start with any questions. I don't see anyone queued up yet, but I'll give a moment to see if anyone wants to raise their hand. And if not, Peter can open up with a question.
Anyone out there? North, south, west, east? Daniel, you were so struck by the film in Beirut that you sent us an email. Martha has a question. All right, from Berkeley, California.
Okay, so can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, so I think in your introduction you maybe sort of explained some of this, but so I was watching the film last night, and you know, there's definitely a narrative arc to it, and it works really well, and it almost is like it's scripted, and it sounds though that there was a lot of sort of fortuitous things happened along the way. I mean, I didn't realize that you'd done a survey of them beforehand, and then these characters emerged from that, but. I don't know how much of it was, did you have to find that narrative arc that made sense to find the characters? And then the things that happened, there's the drama of the CAFA tournament and the getting the scholarship or the opportunities for Sadiq to come to the United States and then Saad coming. That's a Hollywood script, but how did that happen? What if those things hadn't happened? I mean, how did you end up seeing this arc coming through? And I guess one thing that only came through at the very end was that how important you were to the story. But even though, and I have to appreciate that you didn't show up in the film, a lot of these films end up being about the American who does everything.
Okay, first of all, this is why I'm so, well, thanks for the question, because this is why this is fun for me. Not just fun for me, this is why I think these conversations are important. Because you guys have a special ability to kind of, not just because of your interests, but your academics and, you know, your professions, to like look at this analytically and say, not only is there a narrative arc here, but what happened and why did this, you know, why were I was involved. And hopefully you can appreciate that once from doing the surveys to thinking I was going to just follow this in a documentary-like fashion, all of a sudden I was presented with this series of circumstances that in a journalistic way are compromising, in the sense that, you know, anybody that's ever been and covered a story tries to approach that story and say, I'm here to deliver the truth. Like, this is my job, is to deliver facts. And that's what I aspired to do, and I did everything that I could to do in this film. What the tricky part was is learning from day one that Saad and Sadiq's involvement in the film was going to have major repercussions. And the repercussions that I realized and how kind of deep it got was this continuing conversation, like with my co-producer, myself, and lots of other people, to try to understand if we don't let them tell the story, if they don't get to even begin to speak, how can any kind of truth ever be heard? And that was, and I think the moment that really, like, it hit me that I had to kind of make this turn. And also, as you say, it was really important for me to let these young men tell their own story without me being the white Western, you know, hero that flies in, you know, to save the Africans at the end of the day. And that's not what I ever wanted this to be. Like, my dream was to make this film so that Westerners could maybe get a glimpse into the human spirit of Somalia, Somalia young people chasing their dreams. But also on the flip side is for a place that has never had heroes. Well, I mean, I hate to say never, but for young people that are never exposed to getting to see somebody that looks like them, talks like them, and has walked on their soil, presented on screen, I think that Saad and Sadiq, for the very first time, present a role model. And I got a text message from Sadiq over WhatsApp at 5 o'clock in the morning on a random April morning, and it was him saying, JR, I need help. And that's where he had been arrested by the Kenyan police, because Sadiq was in Kenya, Saad was in Mogadishu, and I was really struck that at 5 a.m. in the morning that I'm getting a WhatsApp message from Nairobi, Kenya, and he, of all the people that he knows, and he's a 17-year-old professional footballer in Kenya, that there was nobody else that he reached out to. And that's when I realized that the relationship and my having to not having access to these characters on a daily basis and having to talk to them every day through Skype, that there was a relationship and a level of trust that had been built. And because of that trust, I really owed it to them to make sure that my number one priority was that they were safe. And that was kind of the springboard for my kind of like building a relationship with Sadiq off camera. And, you know, along with Liban, the young man that you see in the story, I'm trying to just help some things go along, because I knew that he wanted to play soccer somewhere else. And if I could just off camera help make any introductions, I felt that was my place to do that as a human being, because I knew that he was in a really bad place. So everything after that really did happen organically. So we just try to present the story as it happened. But yes, there was some things in the background that I had to do. When Sadiq arrives in America, he has nothing. Like, I flew to Miami and I didn't even turn a camera on for a week, just because this was a kid that was seeing sidewalks and streets connected, asking how he, you know, I see a police car and I've never seen that before. Like, I've only seen it in the movies. I got an alcohol wipe. Like, I can use that to wipe my hands. You know, I mean, just like basic human things that were happening off camera. And I know that's a really long answer to your question, but that was kind of like this, that was the journey as a storyteller that I was on. And at every step of the way, I was trying to figure out how to leave myself out of the story so that it could just unfold. And then the same thing with Saad. We just tried to let his story play out, but I also knew that he'd have to leave Mogadishu.
Great. Thanks. How about Daniel?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to watch this. I really enjoyed it very much. One question, how is the perception of your work, or what perception do you expect in Somalia, because you also show like some controversial things, such as that the federation takes passports of the players away, that they don't leave the country. So, yeah, what do you think will be the perception of your work in Somalia?
That's a good question. I think it's really hard to predict, what the Football Federation will say and what, because they were cooperative. I mean, when I first met Abdikani, who's the president of the Somali Football Federation, he was the secretary general, whatever that you want to delineate as being the difference there. But when I first met him in Tahiti, I remember getting up from lunch on the last day that I was there and him saying, you know what this means for Somalia, right? And I really took that personally. Like I felt like this was the old adage for a journalist, that this is the first rough draft of history. And that's how I've always viewed it. So I've never really kind of been worried about what they would think. And I just really don't know what to expect. I have a feeling there are some people will be frustrated. And even with the trailer, there's a lot of Somalis and a lot of East Africans that'll see the trailer and they'll say, oh, you know, of course you start with the violence first. Like that, you Westerners always start with that. Well, that's what Somalia, like I have to frame the story. Like I have to give Westerners that don't even know where Somalia is, you have to give them some kind of basis to start from. So we felt like weaving in the history was kind of important. And I've heard critically a couple people say that they think our updates along the way are distracting and it kind of interferes with the flow of the story. But Somalia's complicated. The archives were destroyed in 2010. There are no archives. And so to the earlier question about being scripted, you could make the argument that some of it in that way is, in a sense, because I would say, oh, this game's going on this weekend. We need footage. Like, can we get some cameramen to go out there? And I would have to hire somebody locally to go record a game because nobody's recording the games. I mean, now they are. But when we started, they weren't. So it was like we were building the archives as we went along as well. So I'm hoping that the Somali Football Federation and other folks appreciate that. I know that, the Somali embassy here in D.C., we've screened the film in Minneapolis and Columbus where there's, lots of Somalis. And it was funny to watch the film with a Somali audience versus any other audience, because they clap in different parts and they get like really excited and they scream and they yell when Sadiq makes the team. And all that part's really, really terribly exciting for me. But I hope they like it, but frankly, I don't care. There's so much corruption from adults, let's just say adults being adults, that it's the young people that care about Saad and Sadiq. And I get messages, I can't tell you how many messages I get and how many Facebook friend requests I get on a daily basis of people that have heard about Saad and Sadiq's story from Mogadishu. And it, of course, it breaks my heart because I know that they think that I'm like some kind of like soccer whisperer and I can help them like get a team. But in the same way, I know what Saad and Sadiq mean back home, and that's what matters. I want them to be able to see like that these kids made a choice to try to chase their dreams and do it the right way.
So I have a question, JR. Sure. Again, I'd like to echo praise for the film and appreciation for you sharing it with us and making some time to talk with us about it. One of the things that I thought about when Sadiq is coming to the United States is the contingencies of U.S. soccer and how I'd like to share the film with friends in South America. How the film obviously explains it, but I imagine I would have to explain the U.S. Soccer Academy system and the MLS and college sports in this country and the amateur status of sports of college sports in the United States. So could you talk a little bit about, on the one hand, you were talking about Sadiq learning about kind of the human element of living life here. What kinds of things did, some of this comes across in the film, but what kinds of things did Sadiq react to with how soccer is played in this country? What expectations did he have? If he were fleeing to any other country, his entry into the professional life of a soccer player would look much different. So could you talk a little bit about that and his reactions and how you shape that story?
Yeah, me too. I was woefully naive. because when he came to the U.S. and he was down there at Nova, they just said, hey, let's call FC Dallas. I had no idea that LA Galaxy, that FC Dallas, that Kansas City kind of had these academy things. And literally there was 2 days left inside the window of FC Dallas, you know, or like that season closing for, you know, the amateur F18, you know, under 18 clubs. I just didn't even know that existed, nor did he. And he had no clue that he was entering an amateur system that didn't pay. So when he got down to FC Dallas and found out that there was, you know, he was going to be living in a house with like 8 other people and he wasn't getting anything. I literally sent him Domino's or Papa John's pizzas every week for, I don't know, 6 months. He didn't know how to grocery shop. He didn't know how, you know, the coach would try to give him some, you know, a couple dollars here and there. And it was shocking to him. Like, he literally could not wrap his head around the idea of he was playing soccer and there was no form of compensation. And we were making this argument, well, you're enrolled in a high school and you're getting your education and you get to be in America. But none of that rang true. Like, he was just like, I'm doing a service. Why am I not getting paid? So there was a real journey there. And even leading up into the NCAA, I mean, we don't lead to this in the film, but I pulled Sadiq, you know, this gets personal too. Like, once he was at FC Dallas after, I don't know, it was approaching April, and knowing how deep he had gotten into the film and how much we were following the story, I knew he could go back home to Kenya or out to Kenya or Somalia. I didn't think Kenya was safe either. We knew he had to apply for asylum, and applying for asylum and letting him get what he wanted to do, which was to go to college. He needed some grades and he needed an ACT score. So I flew him out to Los Angeles and he stayed at my place for a little while, but he also then went to my sister's home in St. Louis, and he got a 23 on his ACT when he was getting like 11s and 12s. And that 6 week course of him trying to understand like where education met the soccer process was just completely foreign to him. And then we applied for it. He thought he was just going to take a GED and he didn't pass it because there was like an essay that he was struggling with and that really got to him. But we rolled him into high school, and in the process of rolling into high school, you had to be, you know, he was just turned 19, so he couldn't play there. So he was off the field, not only then, but then we thought he was eligible for the NCAA. Like, he was graduating from high school, he had the grades. And when we were applying, the NCAA kept asking all these questions. Like, they wanted to see all of this information from Africa, and he couldn't understand for the life of him why they would ask all these questions, because for him it was trauma. Every time he got re-asked a question from the NCAA over the course of 9 months, they approved him 2 weeks before the high school, before the season started at SLU. So it just led to all of this, you know, day after day of, I quit. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to play soccer anymore. And so to like foreign friends, et cetera, like, this is the piece of the conversation. Even with foreign, I talk with coaches now all the time. And I said, these conversations with foreign players, and when you're even inside your academies, and the integration of culture, I think, was a fascinating journey for everyone involved. It was really difficult. But leading with empathy and understanding what it's like for these young men that don't understand our system to try to assimilate is, I think, we could have panel conversations about that for a long time to come. And I think it's an important one, because if any kids ever want to come out of any other part of the country, this journey has to start when they're 10 or 11 or 12 and make sure that the, you know, the school piece is in line.
Great. Thanks. Martha, you have a follow-up.
Yeah, actually, just on that point, if you haven't already, it would be great to write up some of those lessons, because I think that's so important. So many people want this soccer dream. Even Americans want the soccer dream, and it's really unlikely for most people. So that's one thing. But the comments that I had were specifically about the film, and there were just some things that I really liked, and I'm wondering on one of them if there was something more with it. And sure. So one thing that I really liked was when you interspersed the scenes of Miami Beach and Lido Beach, because I think that was a subtle way of signaling to Americans that there are really cool beaches in Somalia. I mean, people that I know on Instagram are like, yeah, come to the beaches in Somalia, and I'm not going to go myself. But I really liked the way you visually did that, and you sort of showed how beautiful it was there. So that was one comment. The second comment, though, was I also really loved how you had this female Somali reporter talking about the games. And I actually have two questions. I guess I would really like to know more about her if that was just sort of accidental. And I would say that because my experience and is that Somali women are incredibly powerful. They're not shy. They're out there doing all kinds of things. So I wasn't surprised to see her there, but I was really glad that she was there. And again, if you have more about her. And I have another question, but I'll leave that for another time.
Yeah, sure. I'll try to answer this one as quick as I can. Like you, she fascinated me too. And it's the resilience of the Somali people, but it's the resilience of Somali women and the backbone of, and it's really kind of my understanding and learning through Sadiq and other players as well, is the reverence, like, and just how the affinities for the role of their mothers and their grandmothers in their lives. And for me, on the most basic human level, what I talk to Sadiq about all the time is if they have that much power at home, if you love them that much, then why is the continued suppression of, you know, not involving them in politics? Well, now there's been some political things that are, you know, they're trying to make it a point at least to have some of them be in the discussion for parliament members, etc. So, yeah, it was really important, I thought, to include her. Because I didn't, there was a piece of me, you know, Men in the Arena comes from a Teddy Roosevelt speech that he gave at the Sorbonne in 1910, where he, of course, talked about being engaged into democracy. And that line inside of that great speech in Citizen Republic is the man in the arena, which is to give your blood, sweat, and tears and to dare greatly. Cadillacs running commercial campaigns. We started the name of the film well before that. But the idea of the men in the arena, I always struggled with the word men. You know, I was raised by my mom and my sister and my grandma, you know, and I understand that same kind of, like, many of these young people in Somalia are raised by their mothers who sacrifice everything to make sure that they just live. And I thought that she was incredibly powerful. And she, every time we post something on Instagram or Facebook, she's one of the first people to comment. To, like, my brothers, to my heroes, to our heroes. I mean, like, the language that she uses just continues to fascinate me, because I'd love to make a film about her. And then, you know, because she was in the front half of the film, I knew when the Somali national team was leaving, we were going to Kenya, and I knew that there would be no cameras to get them leaving the airport, and I hadn't met any journalists on the ground. So I had found somebody to get some of that footage for us from the soccer team. And it just so happened that she was there doing something for, like, Radio Mogadishu. And I've actually worried about her safety a lot in this film, because she's still there. She's still engaged in conversation. We got Saad and Sadiq out. Like, they would be, like, the central people, you know, that I think al-Shabaab would want to target. But I worry about her. And I hope that the film doesn't place her in any kind of danger. It's something I think about a lot. But as far as, and I don't mean to say that flippantly at all. And then as far as the scene of Lido Beach, you know, shooting in Somalia, which is just, if you're not familiar, when you land on the ground in Mogadishu, you're immediately met by your plane. Your security teams come out, meet you at the gate. They funnel you through security, and you're immediately thrown into a blacked out SUV, and you go through the security zone, and then you're across the wire. Mogadishu is set up in a militarized, like, security zone where AMISOM, the UN, there only used to be one embassy in Somalia. The Libyan embassy stayed through the entire war, and now there's like 20, and it's only the last 2 years that embassies have come back. Once you leave that line, you're amongst the people. You're amongst the story. Now you can go get it, but that's also where it's insanely dangerous. I can't get out of a car unless instructed. Paths to where you can go are predetermined. So when you go to Lido Beach, it is stunningly beautiful. But I'm the only white guy, and I have five guys with guns around me walking me to the edge of the water. So getting that scene and showing how beautiful it is, and then comparing that to Miami Beach, I thought was a really great edit. I thought Brian, you know, did a really great job with that. I thought that was important. And I just love that Sadiq, like, you know, just wrote his mom's. That's the kind of, it just blows my mind every time that I, like, we'll do a Q&A after the film and somebody will ask a question to Sadiq And I'll think that he'll just give this, you know, random answer. And it has some kind of depth to it that I never expected. In the same way that he put his finger to the sand and just said, thanks, Mom, I'm in Miami. I'm like, your mom didn't even know you were coming to Miami. But it was just, it was kind of, they just continuously surprise me and how the depth of their character and how much it goes back to moms and women and society.
So this is Martha again. I don't see anybody else hopping in there, although Daniel has a question. But on that, that I think that I had another question, and it kind of has to do with Somali culture writ large. And part of it is the poetry. I mean, and Somalis are really known for the poetry. And so I think I sent some of that there, although it wasn't highlighted. And another thing that was totally absent, that wasn't mentioned at all, which I know some Somalis would be really happy that it wasn't mentioned, and I'm wondering if you confronted it at all, was the clan structure.
The clan structure is a huge problem. And I think there was just kind of like, how many problems can you present? And I think that's why we put Mark Bowden in where we did, which was just to try to give some kind of, a quick history, you know, and also too, not only the clan structure, but to go back and talk about Somalia and why it is the way it is. I mean, not only did they have a dictatorship, with Siad Barre, but the Cold War and the U.S.'s role with Ethiopia and the Russian role of arming, you know, most of these folks is a story too that I, you know, so it's like, how many things can you include without getting mired and pulled away from just kind of being on this character journey? And the clan piece never really showed itself that much. Interestingly enough, it shows itself when Saad went to, this isn't in the film either, but when Saad leaves Kenya, we got him, he was going to, at the very end of the film, he goes to the Olympics with his team, and they weren't allowed to go to Kenya, and they went to Djibouti. And there was a 30-day stamped passport, of which they were supposed to have gone to Kenya. Sadiq told Saad to tell his team that he had a knee injury and he needed to come to Kenya to see Sadiq's doctor. Well, Sadiq doesn't have a doctor in Kenya, but that was a pretty great excuse. And there was 15 days left stamped on his passport. So he got into the country of, he got into Nairobi legally. And then we got his passport renewed and he stayed in Somalia, or he stayed in Kenya for 9 months waiting for a country to take him in. And it ended up being the US. And during that process, all the Somalis that were living in Nairobi thought he was from a different clan, and because he was from this town of Afgoye, and they didn't really want to accept him at first. But Sadiq said, he's a soccer player, and like, just please, like, give him a chance. Just make sure he gets some food. He has no money. He has no nothing. He can't speak the language. And within a week and a half, the entire Somali community had like embraced him. And there was some clan structure that was preventing that. So I thought that was a really interesting story, but I never had time to get into that in the film. Amen.
Great. Emmanuel, do you have a question?
It's my turn?
Daniel was...
Oh, then yeah, we'll go to Daniel first and then Emmanuel.
Oh, okay. How is a rebuilding, recovery of the domestic football? I mean, you showed us the stadium, which looked like, I mean, sad because it looks not like there could be soon a football match, and which was used for executions, etc., by Al-Shabaab. Do they want to like reuse the stadium later on for the national team? When do you think the national team can play its matches in Somalia and not abroad? How is the league developing clubs? Do you have more information on like rebuilding football within Somalia?
Yeah. So FIFA just finished their last piece of what they call like a grassroots thing, where they come in and help with coaching and refereeing. The Somali league seems to be in pretty good shape. They're playing at Banadir Stadium, which you see in the film. That's that got the turf in 2012. And they've gotten funding to kind of add some locker rooms and things like that, which were never there before. last summer, something happened during a game and somebody was just shot in the middle of the crowd, at gunpoint from a guard. So there's still like fans are coming in droves to games. I think it's a one cultural piece that seems to still be alive there, you know, that is kind of not been messed with by al-Shabaab. And al-Shabaab is still wreaking havoc. I mean, the daily suicide bombings and targeted shootings, I mean, it's really, they're trying to get elections done, but the Klan stuff is really interfering with that. So FIFA seems like they've kind of given the money that they want to give. The local league seems fine. It's when they try to do anything organized, you know, for traveling to a SACAFA or anything like that, where it's just missing. And I think the corruption within the Somali Football Federation, you know, when a government is this corrupted, a society is this corrupted, it just feels like at every turn somebody has to be paid off to survive. So there's almost a piece of me that has an understanding for why that they do what they do. But I remember when we got to Kenya and there was like four balls for the entire team to train with. And that made no sense to me. I was like, what? They're giving you guys a lot of money. I don't understand where all the balls are. Like, and there's no sideline. AFC Leopards, the team in Kenya, when we went there, they had their assistant trainer who was a friend of Sadiq's, and he just volunteered to come over. So if anybody gets hurt, if anybody has even the slightest thing, they don't have a clue how to take care of them. One ankle injury could mean you're done. So that kind of just rudimentary ability just to help players on the fly, and not to mention the mental toll that all of these kids have. So I think that's kind of the status of where Somalia is. And without peace, it becomes hard to, you know, to kind of make that breakthrough. As far as the Mogadishu Stadium itself, a contract has been signed with the Chinese to build five major institutions. So one is Mogadishu Stadium. One is the National Arts Theater, where the bombing was at the open of the film. And there's a couple other structures as well. As you know, the Chinese are doing tons of infrastructure building in Africa. And for Somali in particular, the Mogadishu Stadium is the strategic point in the city. And it seems that they're on the cusp of getting soccer back in that place, but it's going to require real cash. And it's going to require safety. And there's this reluctance to give up the stadium because al-Shabaab will just immediately kind of try to go after it. But
there's no fan violence. This was a problem in Lebanon after the civil war. They had to ban for some years the fans from the stadiums because there was so much violence among fans.
For a place with no rules, there doesn't ever seem to be violence among fans.
Yeah. But now, because of the long civil war, sorry for the follow-up question, there's such a large diaspora of Somali people. Do some of the diaspora in the national team, do they get people from the diaspora? Or they are all like homegrown?
This is what befuddles me. I for the life of me, I don't understand why they wouldn't call Assad not Saad or Sadiq, because their immigration challenges now. But, you know, with all of these international players, you got to fly them in, right? And you got to bring them into camp. And you can't train in Mogadishu because, you know, when Sadiq went back to Mogadishu when he was 16, because he spent most of his life in Kenya, he got death threats. The first night he was there, he was held at gunpoint by, we don't know if it was al-Shabaab or who it was. His bus was shot at, and he got death threats for going on the radio and talking, saying like, hey, I'd love to move back to Mogadishu full time if there was more peace. And then he got tons of death threats and it almost prevented him from joining the national team. So it's like when these Western players try to get back in to the fold, there's all these complications around safety. And I just don't know. And there's also this weird thing that, like, once you're 21 or 22, it seems like your career is over. So it doesn't seem like there's this understanding inside the organization that's when the kids are just getting started. Like, why wouldn't you bring them back at 24, 25, 26 when they have, you know, the elder statesman to bring to bring experience back to the club? I don't understand why that piece is missing. It really befuddles me.
Great, thanks. Okay, let's move on to Emmanuel.
I would like to thank JR for this movie. It really inspired me and made me to see of how important it is to know for sport and stuff. But I think most of the question I wanted to ask you, you already explained with this question of Daniel. But what my question was, what does this Somalia national team look like, or like the national Somalian country do to guys who were inspired by this move of Sadiq, of, you know, the boys coming up with the new skills of trying to make it to for their dreams to come through.
So are you asking specifically about Saad and Sadiq or other young people that might want to play somewhere else?
Yeah, actually for other young players who want to come on.
I think on a personal level, I've been trying to, you know, when we screened in Columbus, there was two folks with the Columbus crew that were saying, you know, one was actually happened to be Somali background, saying, how can I help players in Kenya, that, you know, because there's a ton of Somalis in Kenya. How can we help, you know, kids figure out how they could enter the American system or, you know, get the path going? So on a personal level, I've just been trying to make introductions, you know, try to help people that we met at the Somali national team, because they've kind of been on this island, you know, like existing in this space of no knowledge. And the biggest challenge that Somali players have is that their passports allow them to travel nowhere. Like, they literally, it's a license to travel nowhere. Like, no one will allow them to come into the country. Their passport is just looked at like it's, you know, you are a terrorist because they fit the profile. You're 19, 20, 21. And because of the immigration crisis, it's a real challenge, which gets back to, you know, when I have conversations with Abdikani or whatever, you know, or any of these other people at Somalia football, it's that you have to build up the places of trust. So the national team coach that came in from Somalia, or came in from Tanzania, that you see, the guy that in the film that says, spaghetti, rice, fish, and meat, like, that's all they'll eat. Like, these players can play, but they need development. We have to work with them. That guy. It's the other East and Central African countries. The coaches that have familiarity, that, like, play against them in Sakafa, that has to be the outlet. And what I've told all of the boys on the national team that have reached out to me and said, hey, you helped Saad and Sadiq, what can, it's like, look, the only thing that you can do is make a tape for yourself. You know, get your clips together. You're recording games now. Put your tapes together and send it to other African coaches. And then, you know, the frame that Sadiq says of, like, you know, will you get the chance to make your dreams come true if you're ready? It's like, if you're ready, maybe you can create a chance for yourself. So if you go to Sakafa, get the footage. So that's one thing that I've been trying to educate some of the coaches on. And, you know, with Saad and Sadiq's journey is to say, record your games, or if they're being recorded, get the footage, make a tape, and send it to a coach. That's your chance. America, Europe, that's tough. That's next to impossible. Yes, there's, you know, exceptions to the rule, but that's your channel. And I think that's what we learned from Saad and Sadiq, and that's a real channel. Like, they can go play in Tanzania. They can play in Uganda. They can play in Kenya.
Maybe that's a good opening to a question that I had, JR, about the Somali diaspora, particularly the Somali diaspora in Kenya, which, of course, is deeply felt in the political sphere, in the economic sphere, in the cultural sphere. You know, the Eastleigh neighborhood in Nairobi is like a little Mogadishu, and it's not even that little. You know, every terrorist attack in Kenya is promptly blamed on all Somalis. I interviewed the author of City of Thorns a few months back, Ben Rollins, who wrote this great book on the Dadaab refugee camps, which are mostly but not exclusively Somali, you know, the largest of its kind anywhere in the world. I was interested in the movie about the ways in which you tried to grapple with this almost bifurcated experience of Somalis who are in the diaspora versus those in southern Somalia, but particularly the Somalis in Kenya, because Sadiq is such a gripping, you know, central part of the story. How did you handle that difference? Because people in southern Somalia are experiencing the game and life in a very different way, it seems to me, a lot of the times, than those in Kenya. And the AFC Leopards coach plays such a huge role, and there's so much xenophobia in Kenya towards Somalis. Can you say more about that and how you as a filmmaker and as an individual tried to cope with this?
Yeah, I mean, that was the most difficult part of the film in general, right? And I think if anybody wants to be a critic of the film, please go ahead. I mean, Somalia's just, it's so complicated. You know, because of the diaspora and because of being exposed to new culture, every time, you know, even up in Norway and Scandinavia, and then like Somali, like there's Somali leagues in the diaspora in Australia, Canada, East Lee kind of has their own heartbeat, you know, for Somali culture. So all of these places are human beings that happen to be Somali going to live lives that get shaped by new cultures and new places. And that's why Saad and Sadiq, you know, when we met them, I mean, I spent months and months and months, not that you can, from books, I created a list of like 100 different people across the arts, across journalism, etc. And I just followed them every day for, you know, like 9 months before I ever even talked to Abdulkani. And I think I started realizing how kind of fragmented, like all of the, you know, no different than an American society could be, right? It's like all these little pockets of people are just trying to figure out how to survive being entrepreneurial and do what they do. And I think what we realized through Saad and Sadiq's story was that Saad in their friendship was Saad is kind of like managed to avoid the war because he was on the outskirts of the town in the village. And it was only kind of when the war came to him with Al-Shabaab in 2010 that he got caught up. So his experience of soccer and like is almost from like a village perspective. But then Sadiq kind of got to touch it at both levels. He was back in Somalia. He was in Kenya. And he's almost closer to being a part of the diaspora. And then every time I would try to engage a professor or like somebody at Ohio State or something like that, that may be a part of the diaspora, to maybe weave them into the film to kind of give us some cultural context, it just got cloudy. And at every turn, I realized the only way I can make this film is to be, you know, is to be true to what the story is, which is to just follow what's happening in their lives. Like, this is a story about two young men that are just trying to exist on the planet. And this is what happened. And it's like every time I tried to like include more, I found myself like, I just have to get back to them. It's them. That's who I'm following. And that was kind of my guidepost. I don't know if that answers your question, but that was what I tried to do.
Was there something though that really sort of you focused on? Because I think you're right, from a narrator's point of view, from a narrative point of view, you know, having the two individuals is a very helpful way of keeping focus and humanizing and personalizing the experience and the story. But was there something that you saw that maybe, because like, for example, the AFC Leopards coach, okay, let's take that example. He seems unusually sympathetic to Sadiq, to me.
Yes.
And I, obviously part of it is that Sadiq's a very good player. And anybody who wants his or her team to succeed would like to have a good player, especially a very good young player, an ambitious player, a hardworking player, you know, a good team player with him. But, you know, I also, there were hints maybe in the movie, I don't remember, I saw it a few days ago, but certainly in Kenya, that's not a typical attitude towards Somalis.
No, it's not, and it's getting worse, right?
So,
I mean, I think that's why.
So it seemed like there was a messaging going on there. Yes, it was truth telling. This person was real. That was his perspective, and it was a very honorable and humane one, albeit a self interested one. But were there others that you didn't include? For instance, maybe the when they detain him, I think that's one, perhaps. But were there others? I don't know. I'm just trying to see, you know, where you made your choices and how, as you tried to deal with this Scylla and Charybdis of you know, the Somalis in Kenya versus the very different experience in southern Somalia, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the persecution is kind of everywhere. And I think where we tried to at least address it, I mean, we certainly didn't avoid it. I mean, here's the thing about terrorism. And here's the thing about Somalia and kind of these complicated war zones these days. Because of asymmetric warfare, the attack can come from anywhere at any time. You know, it was Michelle Shepard who I heard on the radio. I had no idea who she was. And she's the one that ended up helping me get into Mogadishu. And she said at the time when I went in, you know, JR, it's different because it's changing now. Like you just don't know where it's going to come from. And so that level of fear that exists on the surface is the biggest challenge we had in the film just in general. Like, how do you show this kind of ever-present fear that exists amongst Somalis, amongst Kenyans, and anybody that interacts with Somalis in general? yes, the broadcasters, everything else. It seems like to me that the broadcasters, the Kenyan coach, Washington, yes, he was sympathetic. But it's funny, like that's why being able to tell a soccer story, all that stuff kind of peels away. You know, like all the, you know, the it was only when Sadiq got arrested that we had the opportunity, I felt like, to get to what you're speaking to, which is this really clear sense that, you know, they don't like them and they're uncomfortable with their being there. So I don't know that it was deliberate that I tried to leave it out at all. And in fact, I would have liked to have had more of it in there. I think if there's a complaint about the film, it's like that people didn't feel that they were in danger. Well, they were, but it's a hard thing to capture.
Absolutely.
And I hope that answers your question, but I don't really know how to get at it any other way.
No, that's really helpful. Thank you.
It's just such a, this is why this took 3 years. I mean, Somalia is like really, really tough. Like it's really, really hard. And even when you film there, like I would try to hire people and they don't have internet. I mean, they do, but then like to send video files, they would send files and they would do a 2-camera shoot that I would pay for. I would do drawings and then I would send them, say, this is how it should be set up, to try to find a light. This is how you could do it. Make sure you have, I would teach them what to do. And then they would do it and they would send it back and it would be terrible. And I'd say, you have to go back and like go do this interview again. And this was just going to games to try to create the footage to get it to exist. So it's just, it's a really, really complicated place.
Thanks. How about Andrew?
Okay. I have a follow-up because I also was struck by even more broadly, besides just the issue of how Somalis are treated in a place like Kenya, but the broader sort of optimism of the film. And I appreciate you saying at the beginning that in some ways that was the point. You wanted to tell a story about Somalia that was not the typical kind of narrative of terrorism and all the bad things. But as you're conveying very effectively and describing it, it is a really complicated place. And the ways out and the ways forward are complicated. I mean, I think the stories about Sadiq at FC Dallas, I think in the film it kind of comes across like, you know, here's this great opportunity for him, but then you're giving us the backstory of, well, but actually there was some frustrations. And when I watched it, I was like, that house just looked suspicious to me. It's like all these, it looked like 16, 17 year old boys living on their own, going to kind of a sketchy charter school. Like it seemed potentially a little exploitative. So anyway, I guess
yes.
I want to follow up a little bit on the choices, particularly like at the very end. I was noticing the sort of epigraphs at the very end. The Somali, it's labeled as a Somali proverb that if people come together, they can even mend a crack
in the sky.
And then it also said at the very end, the best way to show support for Somalis on their path to peace is to show them the world cares. And I guess I'm like those sort of messages from an academic perspective, it seems like I hear you saying like, it's too much to get into the complications, but from an academic perspective, like the complications are important. It's sort of important for people to recognize that this is not as simple as just like if a few good-hearted people care, then
sure,
things will work out. That there's a deep social history, there's a lot of geopolitical stuff going on. And so I just wanted to ask you to kind of unpack those epigraphs, why you feel like those were the messages that you wanted people to take away.
Yeah, sure. And I'm glad you asked the question because I think it's super important. There is plenty of academics. There are plenty of policymakers. There are plenty of journalists, including Michelle Shepard and others, that are doing incredible reporting. You know, and there's women like Ilwad Elman at the Elman Institute that are helping young people and doing like incredible work. I mean, there's like fascinating work on the ground that's being done at the teenage level and like trying to help these kids find jobs and doing all this stuff. And I really genuinely, like, that's what I unpacked myself, was that there's real opportunity here. And there's like hundreds of thousands of kids that are in schools, that are up in Puntland, they're up in Somaliland, that there's kids in Mogadishu. I mean, at Lido Beach, there was a shooting 5 months ago. The goalkeeper in the film that you see at the very end, he was at Lido Beach at dinner, and it was attacked, a suicide bombing attack. And they came in and they shot the place down. Like 20 some people were killed, and he was shot in the arm. A week later, he posted a picture to Instagram. This is Ahmed, the kid that you see in the very end of the film with Saad inside the stadium saying he hopes it's rebuilt again. Yeah. He was shot in the arm, and a week later he was studying for his final exams. So that's what I experienced, was I'm getting messages from people every day saying, like, my Facebook picture is me holding a Somali flag. Kids in Mogadishu are like reposting that picture of me holding the flag. And I'm not saying like there's this altruism of like I have the hope thread. What I'm getting at is that there's real stories of kids, and a lot of them, that are looking for an opportunity. And I think that like until you understand that they're on the ground and you understand what's happening there and that you actually care to understanding what's happening, that it is complex, you can't ever get to the next stage, which is to figure out what to do. Because I don't know what to do. But I do know that there's more than what you read in the news every day. There's hundreds of thousands of kids trying to figure out how to make their way in the world. And so that's why I kind of tried to poke and pry and put some of these things in there, because it was my experience as a filmmaker and what I touched on the ground.
Can I just quickly follow up? I'm curious. Thank you for that answer. I also wondered, in terms of how you're trying to get the film out there into the world. I mean, just being in the media world as opposed to the academic world, whereas I think you rightly say it's easier for academic types to say it's complicated, look, here's the complications. But have you gotten feedback from potential distributors, things like that?
So we just actually sent the film today to our distributor for closed captioning and all that good stuff. So it'll be released in April, iTunes, Amazon, etc. And then what we hope is that, you know, either a Netflix or one of these guys comes along, you know, for the worldwide rights for licensing. And, you know, my goal obviously is for it to make sure that it gets back to Somalia. Like, I want it to end up in the hands. I'm sure it'll be pirated the hell out of. but once it gets there, that's like, once it gets back to Mogadishu, that's fine. Like, that's what I really hope happens, is that, you know, as many kids as possible get their hands on the film. But, you know, also from a South America standpoint, the broadcaster that you see at the open of the film, Supersport, they're based out of South Africa, and they broadcast in Kenya, Tanzania, etc. They do the SACAFA tournament. I hope those guys license the film. You know, if I would love for like a BBC or somebody like that to grab it, I doubt that happens. But now it just kind of gets piecemeal. You see if somebody grabs the film in whole or in totality, or if it like it gets spread separated by regions, but it should be out in April. It's just the whole like kind of distribution by theater type thing that is, you know, the traditional platform that's like you can't make any money on, that's really difficult to do. We've been to several film festivals, and I'd obviously like to go to more.
Yeah, I guess I was curious, like, if you actually got feedback in terms of the way, the thematics of the film or the way that they wanted it.
Yeah, no, I haven't got much of that. Like, I think that if I would have premiered at Sundance, you know, and if I was on some kind of, like, award trajectory, that, you know, The Hollywood Reporter and other people like that would have sliced and diced the film to, you know, your heart's content. But we haven't got too much of that yet. And maybe when it comes out in April, there'll be more of that. And to be honest, like, that's fine. That's fine with me. Like, come be as much of a critic as you want. Like, that means people are talking about it. I mean, like, that's really not in a false reality TV standpoint, like, bad news is good news. I want there, like, it's a freaking really complex place. And we're the only film that I know of that's tried to go in there and just, like, really just, like, follow character. That's all I tried to do. And around that character, like, I put some messaging, you know, like, some messaging in the sense of, this is what happened, this is how things unfolded. And the only things that I put is the very end, is on a personal note, is to like to show that you care. That's the very last thing in the film. And that actually came from, speaking of poetry, that actually came from Kanon. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. He sang the World Cup song in 2010, Waving Flag. And he did a big panel discussion with Bono during the famine. And all of these, you know, all of these white folks in the audience all stand up saying, what can we do? Where can we send money? And he's like, the first thing that you can do is try to read and understand just how complex it is. And like almost, and like show that you care to understand what's going on there, that it's complicated. And so that's kind of where that stemmed from for me, was if you take the time to understand what's going on there and care, it's almost like that bullying effect. If the whole world looks at your passport and you can't travel, like you too will feel like you are bullied. So if the world starts to look at you and see that you have a Facebook feed that represents the other side of the culture, you know, that shows that you're kind of finding at least a way to show a human thread. That doesn't mean when the bad things happen that they don't happen, because they do.
Great, thanks. Itamar.
Thank you very much.
There you go. I've unmuted you. Go ahead.
Great. So thank you, Joe. I really enjoyed the movie. And I wanted to know if you hear any political comments from Saad or Sadiq on the situation in Somalia, perhaps their inputs on how Somalis from the diaspora can promote a change back home. I mean, it's not something new that the footballers use their social or cultural capital they've gained from football to bring a change in their country. So I was wondering if you heard something about it from
I'm so glad you asked that, because that actually gets part of back to, you know, why I think the film is important, because it's them. It was like the first day that I met all of them, that all, like, not just Saad and Sadiq, but the one kid, the goalkeeper that came in from Holland, they all talk about, because of their parents, you know, and the stories they hear about how Mogadishu and Somalia used to be. Remember, Somalia's only been this mired chaos for 25, 30 years. I was at the Library of Congress talking today about the early 50s, 60s, 70s, and how it was the Saint-Tropez, you know, of Eastern Africa. Like, it was beautiful. And it's only, you know, like a cobble that has been destroyed. So, you know, Sadiq and Saad's biggest dream is to someday have not just football camps back home, but both of them are obsessed with the idea of like, oh, if I just had education, like if only I would have had education when I was that young, like I would be playing Premier League. Like, or if I would have had those coaches, I'd be playing Premier League. Like, they both in their souls believe that if kids back home get the chance to touch education and soccer, that they have a real shot. And so for me, that's like, that's really fascinating, because I think that that just means that they don't want to give up the hope that there's still a chance. You know, if things get better, they can do something. And as far as the political comments, I think they just get disheartened a lot. You know, it's always, like Michelle Shepard says it all the time too. It's like, for every one step forward, sometimes you feel like you take two steps back. And that's what the oligarchs and the clans and, you know, even Al-Shabaab, like, really tried to make happen. But, you know, like I said before, then you would meet an Ilwad Elman, who, you know, her father was a peace activist in 96. And he was murdered in 96, but in 93, he took street footballers that were just playing games on the street, you know, as the war was breaking out, and tried to organize them. And that's why he created Elman Football Club. Elman Football Club is Saad's team. Mm-hmm. And that is the team that is like having success in Somalia 30 years, you know, 25 years, 23 years later. So if you think about Saad being born that year, 1993, the year of Black Hawk Down, and then this man creating out of street footballers, creating a team. And then he gets murdered 3 years later. And his daughters, who were raised in Canada, have risked everything to go back. They're twins. And now they're fulfilling their father's mission on the ground in Mogadishu and educating tons of kids, doing rape prevention clinics, getting money from Kofi Annan and others from the UN, and trying to help kids find jobs. I mean, it's really fascinating to see this younger generation of Somalis, like Mark and Abdi alluded to, like really trying to do something. And a lot of them have never even been to Mogadishu, and they want to do something. So I think that's really encouraging, and not something that, and something that doesn't, that very rarely gets talked about.
Thank you.
Anyone else have a question in the queue? We have a moment here in case anyone else who has not spoken yet has.
I can say something really quick, and I'll try to make it fast. Yeah. Just about, I think a lot of people, you know, in Q&As and stuff, always want to know what happened to Saad and Sadiq, kind of what's happening now. Hmm. Sadiq came to, or Saad came to America in March. He got here because I took clips of the film and sent them to the department, to the State Department and other senators in D.C. I didn't know anyone. But I said, I think this is important for Somalia, for people to understand that what these boys sacrificed to share their story in the film. And that's why Saad got to America. I never dreamed that that's what would happen, but he did. He lived this summer in St. Louis in a really terrible neighborhood. He immigrated just like everyone else, like a refugee agency got him settled. He would go to my sister's home a lot for dinners because that's where Sadiq is. And St. Louis University didn't give Sadiq an athletic scholarship, because they didn't think he was going to get cleared by the NCAA. They thought they were going to suspend him for 18 games because he had missed so much, or he had stayed in school too long. So what happened is now they're both living with my sister and her husband and their roommates in St. Louis. And just last week, Sadiq received the top amateur athlete in St. Louis, and he was giving the Jack Buck Award. So if you know Joe Buck, the broadcaster, and his father, Jack Buck, there's like a pretty prestigious award that's given out every year. And so Vladimir Tarasenko from the St. Louis Blues, the famous Lou Brock, Cardinal, and Sadiq were all sitting together at a panel accepting an award ceremony. So in that way, an entire audience in St. Louis, Missouri just got exposed to a Somali story that we never heard before.
Yeah, I bet neither Tarasenko nor Sadiq ever expected to be next to each other.
No, but it was so cool because Vladimir Tarasenko went to give his speech, and they showed the NCAA and the Atlantic 10 showed a backstory video of Sadiq. It's really moving. And they showed it, and it was pretty – you think about the political, you know, the political things that are happening in St. Louis, in the middle of the country, where like the heartbeat of what people feel about immigration. And Tarasenko was really moved. It's going to be televised on Fox Sports Midwest, and the first thing that he said was like, I just was really moved by Sadiq's story, and I'm an immigrant too, you know, please excuse my English. And it was like this bridge, like cultural bridge building. It was like, oh, a soccer player, or, you know, like our most famous blues player is like endorsed Somali story, like with a piece that feels tangential. And I don't know, like for me, that felt really beautiful.
Right. Tarminder has a question.
It was a lot of.
Could you start over, Tarminder? I just unmuted you.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the film. I enjoyed it in the sense that I learned a lot, and I'll go straight to my question. And one of the things I've been wondering is, you know, it's a film about two soccer players chasing their dreams, and you know, somewhere like after lots of turns, there's somewhere near something like is really happening. But when you tell the whole broader political context of Sudan, they are going to be much younger and lesser talented players. And your advice is like, get those clips together. Those clips are not really available to a large majority, and the spots on the top and even at the college system are so few. I mean, how do one engage with that knowledge that the spots get out of through this political situation through football are just very, very few? And that's one kind of question that just kept kind of.
I think that's a great question. I think for me, you know, one thing that unfolded for us that we just thought was so great was to see, you know, Sadiq talks about it all the time, that if there's an open space in Somalia, like I remember when he first got to America, he saw a big parking lot at a grocery store, and he couldn't believe that there was just this open parking lot and no one was playing soccer. So for us, like just the representation on film that like Somali crowds come in droves to watch these games, it's a place to gather and have one break a day, you know, from the chaos, you know? So I think that, yeah, of course, like not, you know, even in America, not every kid can play sports. I think that's what you're alluding to. I mean, there's youth development programs. You know, that's what the grassroots FIFA program is trying to do. I've talked to Street Football World and tons of other organizations trying to get a sense of what they do on the ground. So in the process of unpacking the complexities of what happens inside the sport, I also was pushing on the Somali Football Federation saying, well, what about the young women? Are they getting the leadership things that come out in soccer? You know, and all those questions were asked in our interviews. And these are all things that I think, you know, FIFA and like the governing bodies of soccer need to do, continue to push on. I mean, I think it's the soccer community holding FIFA and others responsible for saying, hey, when you do these development programs, make sure that they're broad brushed, make sure that kids are getting touched at the basic human level, learning about teamwork, learning about sportsmanship, learning about like, hey, you got to get your education. And that's why it was so important for us in the film to show that like Sadiq may quit soccer, to be honest with you. Like, and that's, that may happen and that's fine. But at least he, like, he chose to try to get his education. And I think that's what a lot of young people in Mogadishu are trying to do too, is just get their education. That's far better than picking up a gun and joining Al-Shabaab. So I don't know if that fully answers it, but that's kind of, I mean, there's only so much we can, in a character journey that I can kind of show, you know, because there's way more than that on a, you know, not to mention the psychological kind of like post-traumatic stress type stuff. I mean, if I can tell you how many nights I've stayed up with both of those boys just in tears, I can't begin to tell you. I mean, because there's a lot.
Well, your film is way beyond telling us things, way, way beyond the boundary. And that's kind of what I felt was important about the film as well.
No, thank you.
It's not just about the song.
Yeah, and I just like, I really try to keep myself out of the film too, you know, because I think it is their experiences that are most illuminating. I mean, because that's, because I've got to experience it on a personal level. And I just try to take his, every turn
Final
that I could, try to
minutes.
Make sure I ingested that into the film, you know, in some way. Like the comment where Sadiq says, you know,
no cued question.
I want to change my life. Like that was just, I'll never forget, like looking at that and
sure.
just thinking, my God, that's so human, you know, like that's just so, and to me, like if there's one clip from the whole film, like that's it for me. Like I almost opened the film with a cold open with just that shot of him staring into a Skype. Like, and there, by the way, there's no other time in history that this film could have been made.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way. Like I gave both of the boys iPads and just said, try to make diaries. They didn't know how to make them. They didn't know what they were doing. They kept sending me clips of nothing. Like of them like doing Snapchats. And I'm like, no, I need you to do like a diary and tell me what's happening in your life. And that's the only reason we got that footage of Saad inside his village, you know, like with the little kids like knocking the soccer ball around and telling them like instruction. Mm-hmm. It was video diaries and Skype and WhatsApp. And, you know, if it's not for technology, this film never gets made.
Yeah.
Great. We're entering the final 15 minutes here, so we have a couple questions that we can end with. I'll let Peter start.
Thanks, Alex. I was just typing something here. Very interesting observation about iPads and Skype and WhatsApp as a key to making the film. That's really, really interesting. I mean, that the democratization of filmmaking and its relationship to technology in Africa is a topic dear to my heart. But let's set that aside for a moment. And two things. One is the title of the film.
Yes.
Can you explain that it comes from a Teddy Roosevelt speech, and was it 1910? Did I get that right?
Yeah, so it's called Citizen in a Republic.
Okay,
and
but the question is not so much that as much as I don't know if this title really gets to what the movie is about and what it really evokes. Were there others that you thought of or had, because it seems to me like this could be like a movie about, I don't know, gladiators, or it could be, you know, a sort of a glorification of masculinity. It could be a whole number of things. It doesn't speak to me that like when I see the title, I don't think Somalia, I don't think like, you know, hope. I don't think football. I don't think any of those things. So I'm kind of curious about hearing more about that. And then a totally different thing is the role of the United States in this film. And this is not to play devil's advocate too much, but
sure.
You mentioned the Cold War legacy. I mean, there's few places in Africa messier in terms of Cold War legacies than the Horn, where the United States and the Soviet Union not only supported different sides, but often switched sides as well, you know, in the process, screwing up royally, you know, countries and lives and societies. So it seems to me the U.S. kind of emerges with a pretty happy gloss out of this film, and it's probably unintentional in many respects. And, you know, I'm not imputing some kind of political nefarious agenda here, but you know the U.S. is also conducting some pretty heinous things in the region: drone warfare, you know, extrajudicial assassinations. Supporting one of the most undemocratic regimes in the world, Ethiopia, and a cab driver in Washington just recently told me, laughing, an Ethiopian cab driver, that Ethiopia is the only place in the world where an election turned out 100% support for a particular candidate and regime. So is that how Somali athletes and citizens also see the U.S., or is it more complicated than that? And what's your take on the U.S. role there?
I don't disagree with anything that you said. Like, all of those complexities, like U.S.'s role in flipping from support, you know, for Ethiopia, like, yes, all of those things happened. Mark Bowden, and, you know, I talked to Michelle Shepard a lot about this and some others. Like, I just, at every turn that I tried to inject kind of more history into, like, you know, U.S.'s complicated role in this, every time the film slowed down. Like, and I didn't want to lose the audience inside. It was like, I felt like, and maybe that's on me, right? Like, maybe I just tried to stick to character journey and where I could give some framing of what was happening. I think it's a fair comment. But I will say that there is a term called Tarib that is literally every single – Sadiq says in Q&As that all the time that he learned his states and capitals before he learned – like he was learning the Quran, but he learned his states and capitals by the time he was like 8. The U.S. states and capitals. So there is a sense – from all of these kids, and the reason that there's an immigration, part of the immigration crisis coming out of the Horn, is because every one of these kids think that the United States is the last world. Like, the last world, and like completely unattainable, like this is the closest thing to heaven that you can get. So there's this reverence for like what this place offers, which is, you know, obviously in an election cycle, you could say, yeah, America's pretty great. When you go around over the world and realize like how bad people want to get here. Same thing as in Europe, same thing as Australia. They have a deep kind of like resentment for like the Middle East and how they're treated, and how they're treated all over Africa. So yes, that's all there. I can't say much beyond that. What was the first part of your first part of your comment?
The title of the film.
The title of the film, Men in the Arena. Look, you know, in our testosterone infused society, Men in the Arena, on its surface, sounds gladiator-esque. If you dig into the speech a little bit, if you understand what it means to be a critic versus what it means just to be there, just to show up, I think that's what Somalis represent. I think that's what these young kids are doing for me. Like, and that's why when he said it, when the Amazon ambassador made the comment in the film, it's like the Teddy Roosevelt speech that they're there, they're in the arena. They are. Like, it took individual decisions from every one of these kids to try to participate for their national team. And I think that that's what that represents. Like, they're in the arena. And I played with all kinds of titles that were just cheesy. You know, like, I just struggled to come up with anything that had weight. And I felt like Somalia was so complex and so mired in, like, all of these terms and like all these things that just get parsed and pierced. And it's like, I just couldn't get anything that just felt like it was neutral, you know, and then you could take from it what you wanted. And for me, it's like, I like when things have deeper meaning and it creates a conversation. So that's why I did Men in the Arena.
All right. Thank you for that.
I have a last question.
You can hate it. It's cool. I don't care.
unless anyone else in the queue has, I'll offer up a couple moments here, see if anyone in the chat, or else I can ask the last question. There's a big... Martha just posted I think the text of the speech. Anyway, you already got ahead of me a little bit in telling us about... I was going to ask as the last question how Sadiq and Saad are doing. And you've already talked a little bit about that, so I'll get more specific. Very interesting to learn that Sadiq's not on athletic scholarship. I wanted to... I had looked a little bit into the success that he's having despite not being on the athletic scholarship. Could you tell us a little bit about his life within the team? We get to see a little bit in the academy how he interacts with other players. How is forging friendships with other SLU players played out, especially a program that probably has other foreign players on the team, and Saad, we just kind of get a glimpse at the end of his arrival. Maybe you can just tell us more about how he's doing, how he views, the role of soccer in his life moving forward, being in a different place than Sadiq with his, opportunities, all that kind of stuff.
Saad, like he was arrested 8 different times when he was in Kenya. He hid there for 9 months. The national team tried to get him to come up to Ethiopia. And he went, and then we couldn't get him back into the country. He just had it was a terribly exhausting 9-10 months of hiding. And so when he got to America, there was kind of this expectation of, come in shape so you can try to play. We'll try to get you a tryout. Well, when we got here and he moved into that place, he'd never been to school before. Mm-hmm. He went to some basic Quran stuff when he was a kid, but he walked into an American classroom for the first time in his life. I can't begin to tell you what it was like to say, hey, Saad, you have school tomorrow. Are you excited? And Sadiq translated. And he said back, we'll both just start laughing. Sadiq dropped his head down, and I'm like, what are you guys laughing at? What did he say? And he said that, he has class for 4 hours tomorrow, but he doesn't want to miss anything, so he's not even going to get up to go pee. And he said it just like that, said the word pee, right? And I thought, I can't, that's mind-blowing to me. And yes, of course he's excited. And I had this kind of Western prism of which I was looking forward. It's and this is the crazy thing about opportunity, is that both of these boys continuously remind me that they're for the first time getting exposed to opportunity. Sadiq is willing to quit soccer because he has the chance to get an education, and that's all he cares about. He doesn't want to jeopardize that. There's also a huge learning curve about discipline, making a calendar, learning how to to get through your day, on a schedule. So all of these things off camera are really, really stressful and complicated for myself, my sister, her husband, my mom, my little niece who's their biggest fan. But I want for Saad to get back on soccer field for himself because I think he'd like to do it. But he's working at a pizza place, through some family friends. He's making $11 an hour. He's walking there. He's also working at one of the best hotels in St. Louis on the weekends in a gym. One of my friends gave him a $1,500 used car. But it's a stick shift, so we're trying to figure out how to get him driving around. He keeps killing it, So there's all this life stuff where he can't even get himself to practice, without getting help with rides and things like that. He's in the middle of the Midwest. How do you get rides? Right. And he wanted to go to St. Louis because he wanted to be near Sadiq. He could have gone to a city with public transport. And Sadiq is getting, I think other schools are interested in Sadiq. So we're just trying to put the pressure on SLU to pony up and give the cash because it's insane. And really his asylum case hasn't been heard yet. So that's kind of this looming thing in the background that gives us all a little bit of anxiety. Right. That's just a little bit of an update, but he played really well this year. He wanted to quit soccer because he felt defeated. the NCA killed him. Like, he really just was like, I don't care anymore. Like, these people are, like, destroying all my will. And once he got back on the field, like, with his teammates, and I think he really feels like a human again. And I think that he's it's fun to see him not want to live at my sister's anymore and go have his independence. And I'm excited for that for both of them. And Sadie, and you know, Saad's learning how to pay his cable bill on time. And, you know, there's just kind of this life stuff that's getting in the way of trying to figure out how to get to soccer practice.
Well, that's all great to hear. So we're entering the 89th minute, which seems like a good time to bring our discussion to a close. I just want to thank you again, JR, for making the time to talk to us about the film, let alone for making the film. And thanks everyone else for making the time to engage with it. And we'll hope to see you in person soon.
Yeah, likewise. And I'd love to say, I mean, one, you know, send me an email, message, whatever. If you want to chat sometime, if you got holes that you want to poke in, call me. I'd love to talk about it. And, you know, we'd like to do, you know, more screenings, you know, at different universities and get conversation going wherever we can. So if you have ideas, we're welcome and open to it. And again, thanks for the time. Like, this has been a crazy 3-year journey that's only, you know, get wings if people take the time to listen. So I appreciate it.
Thanks. And thanks for pointing to the afterlife of these conversations, because that's often where everyone gets the most out of it, following up, forming relationships, using this stuff in class, continuing to talk about it. So.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, everyone. Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Happy holidays.
Same to you.
Yeah.